Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
We're going to talk about a super fun topic today.
We are both revved up.
It is the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998.
Yes.
Reason we're covering this, obviously, is because the DMCA is one of those things a lot of people cite in various discussions online, things about, you know, what pertains to copyright law, that kind of stuff. And we thought it might be helpful to actually go through and talk about this
what it actually is, what it actually says, and some of the ways that it has interacted with us in the real world, the hypothetical real world that I keep hearing about and don't actually see all that often.
No, that's because we play a lot of Halo. But the whole reason we're tackling this again is that it's you know, when we talk about piracy and we talk about copyright and we talk about intellectual property and safe haven, most of that has to do with the various copyright laws, at least here in the United States. We have several copyright laws, but a lot of it refers back to the DMCA. And the reason why the DMCA is even a thing is because once we started entering the digital era, the landscape changed dramatically. All right. So before the digital era, when everything was analog, you could make copies of stuff, but it tended to be slow. It tended to take a lot of effort on the part of the person making the copy. It was not easy for your average person to make a copy of something and then distribute it.
Right. For example, before digital books, in order to make a copy of a book, you had to either put it on a copy machine, or in ye olden days, break into a printing press room and use the equipment.
Hold some monks at crossbow point and say, illuminate the script faster. It was not easy. And so while there were protections in place to keep intellectual property under the ownership of the person who created it or the entity that owned the rights to it, because, of course, we all know The copyright holder is not necessarily the person who actually made
created the work. Yes.
But anyway, there were laws in place to protect that property. But, you know, it was pretty easy to combat the any sort of piracy just because it was a lot of trouble to pirate stuff. I can remember back in the day when I was a little kid, occasionally using a cassette recorder to copy a song that was playing
off
on
the radio.
Sure.
So, yeah. I did that too. Yeah.
Okay.
Until cassettes, both video and audio, came out, it wasn't so much an issue.
No. And in fact, the various industries that have an interest in distributing and producing and distributing media very much opposed things like cassettes and videotapes. But eventually the government said, no, the benefit of this outweighs the potential threat to your industry. And in many ways, they were very much right, because again, it just was not easy to circumvent that stuff. But once we get into the digital era, now you're talking about the ability to take information. You know, zeros and ones is ultimately what we're talking about here. You could take information and you could make copies of it relatively easily and distribute it relatively easily, especially once the internet
became a thing. And yeah.
So now we're in an era where you could have a book published and someone could take a digital version of that book, strip away any sort of copyright protection that happens to be there, and distribute it freely to whomever they like. And obviously the various publication industries, music industries, movie, television, all that kind of stuff, they were very much concerned about this, and rightfully so. Because if it is easier to get at the material by pirating it than by buying it, that's what people are going to do.
Well, sure. There is a little bit of contention about that. You know, studies, and pretty informal studies as of yet, that people have done about how being able to preview something for free actually increases sales on that paid object.
Sure.
But
yeah. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence
right.
that says that pirates tend to buy more stuff than anyone else does. So in other words, like a pirate will download a torrent of a movie or a television show, really enjoy it, and then go out and buy a copy of it because they want to have that legitimate copy that has all the bells and whistles.
Right. Although publishers are starting to take steps these days, you know, letting you preview more and more of songs online or accessing things through something like Netflix so that you can really check something out and see if it's something that you're interested in purchasing before you.
Right. And Amazon has a lending library.
Sure.
So, but all of these things are kind of subscription-based. So you're still paying into a system. It's just now you've got a lot more options instead of just, I want to buy this site unseen and hopefully I will like it. But anyway, so the DMCA was this series of tweaks to existing law in the United States. It itself was not just a brand new law. It was really to add amendments to existing law in the U.S. and it was trying to bring U.S. law into alignment with the World Intellectual Property Treaties from 1996, two of them in particular, one called the WIPO Copyright Treaty and one called the WIPO Performances and Phonograms Treaty. And so this was also to kind of help make a united front and on the global scale of copyright
right.
holders versus the evil, nasty, horrible pirates who are going to destroy everything from within.
Yeah, those WIPO treaties were introduced in 1996. In 1997, the DMCA was originally sponsored by Republican Howard Coble of North Carolina in the U.S. House.
Yep, and it went through several revisions.
A few iterations that ended up adding some interesting things.
Which we will get to.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to get to it. I am just chomping at the bit to get to the end of this podcast.
It finally passed in 1998 on October 28th when then-President Bill Clinton signed it.
Yep. Signed into law. So let's kind of start talking about what is actually in the DMCA. It's divided into five titles or five sections. And the first two titles are the ones that have the most interesting content from where we are.
The most neat to them, sure.
So we're gonna really concentrate on those first two titles. But don't worry, the other three will get covered. Because Title 5 is a doozy. All right, so Title 1, this is from a summary of the DMCA, so I'm going to just read the little blurb verbatim. The WIPO Copyright and Performances in Phonograms Treaties Implementation Act of 1998 implements the WIPO treaties, and so it amends U.S. law to provide appropriate references and links to the WIPO treaties. It also prohibits circumvention of technological measures used by copyright owners to protect their works, such as DRM. That I added the such as DRM, by the way. That's not in the original language.
But it is very important.
Yes. Adds civil remedies and criminal penalties for violating the prohibitions. So, in other words, this is the part of the DMCA that makes it illegal to try and get around copy protection.
Right.
So, if that copy protection is something that's physically part of a device that plays digital media, or if it's something that's within the digital media itself, so software-based, it is, by the definition of the DMCA, illegal to circumvent that in any way.
Sure.
Unless there are certain circumstances in play.
Right. And it specifically covers unauthorized access, but not unauthorized copying.
Only for fair use, though.
Only for fair use.
Right. You unauthorized copy is still covered if it's not for fair use. So that raises the question, what is fair use? Fair use is this concept where you are allowed to use someone else's work, some other copyrighted work, in very specific circumstances, such as if you were providing commentary about that work. So let's say, for example, that Lauren and I wanted to take something that had been published and copyrighted, and it's about technology, and we wanted to really critique it and explain it and explore it and add to it with our own points of view, and we wanted to quote an entire page of that work. Well, as long as we're doing it responsibly and we are actually providing commentary that adds to the discussion.
It's right, as long as we're not just broadcasting this back out at you for free,
right.
Whereas normally you would have to pay to get it, as long as, we're adding enough to it to make it fair use.
Yeah, that would be fair use. And so you'll often hear people say, oh, like with music, you could play about 15 seconds of music and then that's fair use. No. There is actually not a definition of how much work you can quote or play that remains free, like fair use.
Your intent and your ability to make money off of the product is definitely in a lot of
The
consideration here. For example, there was a case in 2007, Stephanie Lunds versus Universal Music Corporation, which was really interesting. I'm kind of cutting into the middle of the meat here, but I wanted to bring this up while we're talking about fair use, because this was a woman who uploaded a picture of her 13-month-old baby dancing to Prince's Let's Go Crazy onto YouTube. Fun times for everybody, right? It was a 29-second clip, and Universal told YouTube to take it down. They said this violates copyright law. She did not ask for permission to Prince to use that song, take it down. They did take it down, and she sued Universal for legal fees to contact YouTube to get it back up, and also for just messing with her life. And, and the judge ruled in that particular case that it was fair use, and that also companies really do need to check that fair use isn't being broken before they ask for content to be removed.
Yeah, you'll often hear about that too. I mean, there's I didn't write down this particular instance, but I know for a fact that it happened because I know some of the people who are involved. This Week in Tech News Today, that's a show that's done with Sarah Lane, Tom Merritt, and Ayaz Akhtar on Leo Laporte's network. They did a show that at one point they were talking about a video that was also a copyrighted work. And so part of their show is both an audio podcast and a video podcast. You can get it in either format.
Mm-hmm.
And the video podcasts also get uploaded to YouTube. YouTube ended up taking that one down when they got a request from the owner of the video, even though it was very much evident that this was a case where it was fair uses in play because they were providing commentary about the video itself. They weren't just playing the video.
Right.
It was all about really analyzing it and talking about it in a way that was transformative. And it took quite some time to get that turned around. On YouTube's defense, I will say that if they don't act quickly, bad things can happen to YouTube, but we'll get into that. That's a little bit later into the DMCA. Title I also covers some other stuff. One thing it says is that if you are talking about public domain, now public domain is another thing we need to talk about. Public domain is when you have a work that has existed longer than copyright protection will cover that work. So it varies from country to country. So, for example, let's just say we'll make a hypothetical example. Let's say that a country protects any copyrighted work for 20 years. After a work has existed for more than 20 years, it enters into the public domain, meaning anyone can use it any way they like. You can publish as many, you could take that work, you could print out your own copies, you could distribute them freely, you could run down the street laughing like a maniac and chucking copies at people's heads. That would probably get you.
As people do sometimes around Banned Book Week with Mark Twain properties, for example.
You could get arrested for some form of assault and battery that way, but you won't be arrested for distributing copyrighted work because it's in the public domain. You can do whatever you like with it. Again, the amount of time that a work exists before it's in public domain varies by country to country. And in the United States, for example, that number keeps going up because we have some pretty powerful
people who are saying, like, no, we really want to keep Snow White, for example, under copyright domain, even though it published in the 1920s.
There's a certain mouse that has had a large amount of influence on this particular subject. Yeah, it's very true. Disney has been very active in keeping, adding more years to what would be considered copyright. And then there's the question of, well, can we transfer it so that even after the copyright holder has passed away, or maybe the company turns into something else, like, can we keep it so that those rights continue,
can be
even
transferred
longer
to the next? Sure.
Yeah, so there are a lot of issues with that. Well, the Title I of DMCA tells us that the rules about public domain revert to the country of origin of that work. So if the work was produced in, say, France, then whatever France's rules are for public domain would be in play, no matter where else in the world you might be, or, well, in this case, in the United States, because DMCA only covers the U.S., clearly.
Right.
The United States is not adding jurisdiction of the entire world here.
They are not. However, an important part of that Title I is that it names the U.S. as a member country of WIPO.
Right.
And says that it provides equal protection to any other member country of WIPO in the United States, any work from.
Yeah. So in other words, it's supposed to apply the same rules and same rigor for any copyrighted work that's under threat from a WIPO country as it would for anything that's from the United States. So no preferential treatment for U.S. versus non-U.S. And also with this public domain issue, you defer to the rules of the country of origin. So whichever country produced said work, that's the rules that apply for public domain. And the whole unauthorized access versus unauthorized copying, there are some exemptions that are allowed, but they are pretty specific. For one thing, law enforcement, intelligence, and other governmental agencies are exempt from Title I. So, the FBI doesn't have to worry about following these rules, that kind of thing. Other exceptions apply to nonprofit, library, archive, and educational institutions that wish to obtain authorized access to works. So again, the access still has to be authorized. They can't circumvent.
And they can't just do it all willy-nilly. They have to ask first.
Right. But they can make copies if it's for archival purposes.
Sure.
So in that sense, because remember, there's two sections here. There's the access and then there's the actual copying. Because there have been a lot of questions about that. About making things like a gadget that could circumvent the access block part, that's illegal. Mm-hmm. But creating a gadget that can get around the copy protection is not illegal. It's just the access part that you have to worry about. And again, it's not illegal, but you have to use it in very specific circumstances to not get in trouble. Other exceptions include reverse engineering for computer programmers. So if you're trying to make a computer program that can be interoperable with an existing program, then you can start making copies of the existing program in an effort to learn how it works so that you can make sure that your new software works seamlessly with the old software. That's really what that was there to protect. Encryption research is protected. So if your work is designed to analyze, evaluate, and improve encryption technologies, you're protected. Also for the protection of minors. So if there's any technology that's designed to limit access to materials that, you know, are considered to be harmful to minors, but it would otherwise violate part of Title I, those are exempt from the Title I issues as well. And then there's personal privacy, which is if the technology that was used to protect a work would gain or disseminate unauthorized information about a, quote, natural person, unquote, it can be circumvented. So if you were to put DRM on something, and that DRM, as part of what it does, besides protecting the copyrighted work, would also gather information about you, you can then circumvent it.
You're allowed to circumvent that.
Because they consider that the dissemination of the private information is worse than circumventing the DRM. And finally, security testing is also exempt from this. So, yeah, any devices that are primarily designed or produced to circumvent copyright protection, that have only limited commercially significant purpose or use other than to circumvent, or are marketed for use in circumventing, are big no-nos under Title I. Yeah, this is some interesting stuff. Again, really, it's the access that's the big deal here. Copying is still a problem. You can't just copy like crazy. You have to be able to justify it under those rules I was talking about. But the access is definitely a big issue. So, in other words, if something's behind a paywall, you can't circumvent the paywall to get at the stuff, because that's talking about access. Now, if you don't have a paywall, if you can freely access it, or you've paid to get through it, then making the copy, that's more of a question of, do you fall under one of those exemptions?
Right. It does also say, maybe you were getting to this one, but I thought that this one was particularly interesting. It says that it does not and will never mandate that the design of products be such that they specifically prevent the creation of devices made to circumvent themselves.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated and timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly, doesn't it?
It does, but it's really to protect companies and say that if you're designing products, then it's not your problem if someone creates something that can circumvent it.
One other thing that Title I covers, it actually says that the provision prohibits rights holders, meaning people who own copyright to material. It prevents them from applying the copyright prevention or copyright circumvention prevention technologies to free television and basic and extended basic tier cable broadcasts, meaning that you can't put copyright protection on stuff that is freely distributed anyway. So you could not put some sort of copy protection over the air broadcast because of the very nature of how it's distributed.
Okay, so sure. So if you wanted to record something that was airing on PBS, then
you could do it.
You could do that.
Yeah, anything that was on any sort of over-the-air transmission, it doesn't fall under the umbrella of DMCA.
As opposed to a lot of other digital transmissions or cable transmissions that are...
Here's another thing. Like, if that same program that you would have gotten over the air on an antenna, and you wanted to record it on your home system, if it's perfectly okay under that circumstance, it's not perfectly okay if that same program is being distributed over the internet. Interesting, huh?
Huh.
Because it's two different means of distribution. It has nothing to do with the content. It has nothing to do with whether or not it's under copyright. It has everything to do with the method of distribution. What a crazy world we live in. Do you have anything else to say about Title I, Lauren? Anything else?
Because
it gets crazier from here on out.
It does get crazier. Now, there's a lot of interesting court cases that have come up about what it means to be an owner versus a licensee versus a user of any of these pieces of media. Mm-hmm. Especially one case in 2007, Timothy S. Werner versus Autodesk. And Werner sued Autodesk because he had been buying all of the software from garage sales and selling it on eBay. And some of that, one of these things that was included was a program called AutoCAD, owned by Autodesk.
Right. It's a computer-assisted design.
Sure. The user agreement in AutoCAD says that you are a licensee and that your license to use this is non-transferable.
But whoever buys it, that's who
owns
it.
But Werner said it wasn't his fault that someone had sold it to him at a garage sale and that he should therefore have the right to sell it on eBay. And Autodesk said, nuh-uh. And
That is interesting. I mean, what do you do? Because the person who sold it to Werner is essentially the one who's violating that licensing agreement.
Right. But the courts upheld Autodesk. They said no, because you have entered into a legal agreement, period, you are responsible for what you do
with
the software.
That's weird. I would have said that the person who entered the legal agreement was the one who originally bought the software, not him. Because if he bought it from a garage sale, he did not clearly buy it from any retailer that was Autodesk. So it's interesting to me, not that I'm contesting what you're saying, but it's interesting to me that the court would say that because, you know,
They basically ruled that he was never a legitimate owner.
Okay.
Of the software.
Gotcha. So therefore, because he's not a legitimate owner, he cannot be a reseller.
He cannot be a reseller. Correct.
Yes, you know, this is one of those things where it kind of, it brings up that whole idea of the right of first sale, which is if you buy something, then you have the right to sell it off to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
The digital era has really changed that as well, because you sell something that's digital?
And that's the entire issue that I'm talking about with licensee.
Right.
A user versus an owner.
Right. Well, and you can understand Autodesk's point. They might say, well, how can we be certain that, other than, you know, through registration, how can we be certain that the copy of AutoCAD has been wiped from all the computers that the original owner had? So if I bought AutoCAD.
Hypothetically, the key wouldn't work.
Yeah. Right. Which, again, the problem is that there are programs out there
that will generate new keys.
New keys, yeah, so that you mm-hmm. can circumvent it, which you're not supposed to do, but yeah. So this is that's interesting that it goes all the way down to selling stuff on eBay.
Right, yeah. And on a grander scale, this is the same kind of issue that has to do, or Title I anyway, has to do with why unlocking your cell phone is illegal. Because disabling the DRM software in a cell phone that locks it to a single carrier is illegal.
So you can jailbreak your phone, but you cannot unlock it.
Well, you're allowed to jailbreak it to install software.
Right.
But not
unlock it for moving it from one carrier to another.
And this is a thing that once every 3 years, the Library of Congress sits down and reviews complaints that people have submitted to them about various bits of
legislation and
DMCA law. And during one of these tricycles, what are they called? Triennial reviews.
I like tricycles better.
During one of these tricycles recently, the Library of Congress upheld this, that jailbreaking to another network is not legal because, and I do not quote, but this is the gist of their argument, there are so many devices on the market these days that surely you can find one on the network.
Wow. Blame the victim, why don't you? Wow. I definitely feel a sting on this one. But then again, I bought my phone unlocked already because I bought a phone that was designed to be unlocked so that you could buy it and then put it on whichever network. That's still legal, by the way.
Right.
Companies can choose to offer up an unlocked device. You just cannot take a device that has been locked and then unlock it.
Yeah, there's a bit of authorization again in this issue.
Yeah. So, well, you know what? There's a lot more to talk about with the DMCA, but before we do, let's take a quick moment to thank our sponsor.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi.
on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
All right, getting back into the DMCA, we're ready to move on to Title II. And I know some of you are thinking, there are five titles here. How long is this going to go? But really, Titles I and II are the big ones, and the other ones are we'll touch on them, but they won't be quite as extensive. So Title II is the Online Copyright Infringement Liability Limitation Act, which creates limitations on liability for online service providers for copyright infringement when engaged in certain types of activities. So this is, of course, where the term safe harbor comes from, is this Title II of the DMCA. So safe harbor is essentially this idea that if you are an online service provider, and that could be anything from an internet service provider, you know, an ISP, mm-hmm. to a platform that people use on the internet.
Like Tumblr or YouTube.
Yeah, exactly. That if you provide that service, you are not necessarily monetarily liable for any sort of copyright infringement that's being performed by the users of your platform.
Right, yeah.
But there are, again, very specific rules in play. It's not that you're given free license. You can't just sit there and say, safe harbor, I'm okay. You have to actually, show that you are, one, unaware that the stuff is going on, and two, you cannot be benefiting from the fact that infringement is going on.
Oh, right. And furthermore, if a company contacts you and says, hey, this thing is on your site, it's copyright infringement, please take it down. You have to do that.
You have to respond very quickly. And that's one of the reasons why we see these things happen, where YouTube will pull something very quickly because they have to under the rules of DMCA. If they receive that notification
thing.
There's several big cases against YouTube that are all about copyright infringement. Viacom has
a huge case, which is still going on, that was filed in 2007 over a contention of 160,000 clips that had been viewed 1.5 billion times. And they were basically saying, YouTube, I'll quote from it, because YouTube directly profits from the availability of popular infringing works on its site, it has decided to shift the burden entirely onto copyright owners to monitor the YouTube site on a daily or hourly basis to detect infringing videos.
Yeah, so Viacom's saying, hey, this should not be our job, and YouTube saying, hey, it shouldn't be our job either. There's 72 hours worth of material being uploaded every minute. There's no one who can sit there and go over every single frame of every single video that's always being submitted to this service.
And that's basically what the court said. They threw it out without even being tried in 2010. It came back, actually, in April of 2012. There was a reversal. The court said that basically a reasonable jury could have found that YouTube was aware of what was going on and just not taking steps.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's one of the things under DMCA, is that if the service provider is aware of it, they have to take steps to prevent it. Now, again, if it's something where it comes under fair use, that's where it gets muddy again.
Because, really sticky, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, it's not YouTube's job to determine what is fair use and what is not. And the copyright holder is supposed to at least take that into consideration before taking steps. But ultimately, fair use is something that's decided in a court of law.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's all down to, does the copyright holder want to take the steps to actually prosecute someone? And then the court decides if it was fair use or not. That's the real problem with fair use, is that it's really something that's decided after a court case. If no court case happens, so if a copyright holder never comes after you for the way you've used something, you could argue that's because it's fair use. But legally speaking, that's not the determination. It's just that no one came after you. That doesn't mean that they won't come after you sometime in the future. This is the fun part of copyright law, right? So let's talk about some of the things that the limitations on liability cover for copyright infringement, this whole safe harbor idea. One of them is transitory communications. Now, this limits the liability of a service provider when all the provider is doing is acting as a data conduit. In other words, all they're doing is allowing information to pass from one entity to another entity. They're not taking part in whatever the content is. They're the pipes. And
right.
if you are the one who owns the pipes, you cannot be held responsible monetarily for any copyright infringement material that passes along there, as long as you are not complicit in that transaction. So in other words, if you're a service provider and you are not knowingly providing people the chance to send copyright infringed material back and forth, or you're not profiting from it, then you're not liable. But if you're profiting from it, then there's a problem. And that's one of the things against YouTube, is that if YouTube is running ads against videos, then that means they're profiting from those videos. So if the videos are videos that infringe upon something, then there's a case there for DMCA. Now, granted, most of the time, the first step is still saying, take this down. And if YouTube does that, that's usually as far as it goes. But it's something to keep in mind. Next, you have system caching. That limits the liability of a service that retains data to send it later at the sender's discretion. So there are a lot of different ways of thinking about this, but imagine that you have scheduled something to post at a particular time. Well, a copy of that information may be existing on a service provider's site, but what you're saying is that if that material is copyrighted and it's unauthorized, it's an unauthorized copy, the system cannot be held responsible for holding that copy because they're really just fulfilling their end of a service. Again, same rules apply. They can't be complicit. They can't be profiting from it. Storage of information on systems or networks at direction of users, same sort of thing. You have cloud storage. If I have a cloud storage account, and the, you know, part of that is that I am trusting that my provider is not snooping in on all the stuff that I'm storing on my cloud storage, then, you know, you can't hold the cloud storage company responsible if I'm filling up my storage with, you know, all
right.
My,
it can't be expected to look at all every single one of the files
right.
of Jonathan Strickland.
So
or
when
whoever
I've got, when I put my unauthorized discography of Britney Spears up there, they can't, you know, they're not held responsible for it.
Right.
I should definitely hold responsibility for something like that if I were to ever do that. And I fully expect to be held responsible. It also will never happen. Then there's the information location tools. So this is things like search engines. So if you were to type in something in a search engine, for example, you were interested in a particular television show. Let's say, I don't know, Supernatural. And you were to type that in, and some of the links that came back linked to things that were infringing copyright, the search engine would not be held responsible for those links unless, again, it was violating those other rules. So in other words, you can't blame Google for putting a link up to material that infringes upon copyright, because Google's not the one responsible for the material. It's just all
it's
it is.
It's just
is,
reporting.
It's just indexing links.
Okay.
That's all it's doing.
Yeah. Although it does do so with ads, so that makes me wonder if
right.
there's any kind of any of that sticky.
There, that's probably another issue. But again, and they're also told that if someone reports it, they are supposed to block
to
access or take
mm-hmm.
those links down. That's raised a lot of ire in the various communities online about the idea of blocking links, because it's talking about essentially breaking one of the fundamental parts of the internet, or at least of the web, if not the internet. Anyway, that's a different discussion. Those are the four main areas where the liability is limited. They also are, It says Section 512, which is the specific section of the law that this addresses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it says it also contains a provision to ensure that service providers are not placed in the position of choosing between limitations on liability on the one hand and preserving the privacy of their subscribers on the other. So in other words, they are not supposed to be put into any kind of position where they have to identify someone when part of their business is all about, hey,
we
respect your privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they are supposed to be allowed to remain free of that. But even that has some issues. But essentially this is to make sure that they remain in compliance with things like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. So in other words, you're talking about there are two different laws here that kind of conflict with one another. Which one has precedence? In this case, the privacy holds up over the copyright violation. And really the reason why this whole section exists is to prevent companies from having to undergo massive amounts of expenses to defend themselves, or also to endure excessive interference from copyright holders or from government officials. And, so, you know, the fact that this DMCA stuff is in a way, you could see it as a way of bending to the will of copyright holders. That's the way a lot of critics paint it, right? Like,
uh-huh.
The DMCA is just the government laying down in front of copyright holders.
Right, but this one really actually works in the other direction, in the favor of
the service providers
who are just trying to do their jobs and are not necessarily. There was a case in 2006, IO Group filed a complaint against VO Networks for VO Networks had a site that would let users transcode video into Flash.
Okay.
Sure.
Yep.
And IO Group was saying that VO Networks users were transcoding videos into Flash that were copyright infringement.
Okay. So that they were taking videos that were under copyright, and through the process of transcoding them, that was violating the copyright.
Yes. And they said that VO was responsible for this because as a transcoder, they were implicit in the copyright infringement.
See. They were giving the people the ability to infringe.
Yes.
Just from the very nature of what the service was.
And the court ruled that the process was automated and that therefore, yeah, VO had no knowledge and
like they could not know what the content was because the actual process of transcoding had nothing to do with a human being reviewing stuff and saying, "Hey, wait a minute."
It was a really good but a really important clear-cut case to prevent that kind of legal action
sure.
from being taken in the future.
That makes a lot of sense because, I mean, YouTube had, for a long time, was always encoding videos into Flash
mm-hmm.
until it started to switch over to HTML5.
Yeah.
But same sort of thing.
Yeah. And that Viacom case is just kind of spinning in courts right now. Both sides are arguing that the other is burdened with the proof that YouTube and therefore Google had no idea what was going on. And really, how do you prove that someone doesn't know something?
Right. You have to have evidence that they did know. That's the only way you can prove.
Yeah.
You can't prove a negative, but if you are able to prove that they did know and knowingly allowed it to happen, that would be the case.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely? Where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait?
Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Well, let's move on to Title III, which is mercifully short. It's the Computer Maintenance Competition Assurance Act, which creates an exemption for making a copy of a computer program by activating a computer for purposes of maintenance or repair. So essentially this means that if you've got a computer and you need to do some work on it, like you need to repair it or do some maintenance work on it, and you've got programs on there already, you can go ahead and make copies of that stuff for the purposes of doing this maintenance or repair work. But once all that work is done, you then must destroy the copy.
Must destroy the copy, yeah.
Yep. That was Title III. See how easy that was?
The
title,
end!
Title
Yay.
Four. Title Four. Now, this one's a little more wacky because it has six miscellaneous provisions relating to the functions of the Copyright Office, distance education, the exceptions in the Copyright Act for libraries, and for making ephemeral recordings. Also, webcasting of sound recordings on the Internet, and the applicability of collective bargaining agreement obligations in the case of transfers of rights in motion pictures. And it's just as exciting as it sounds, people. So, in general, ephemeral recordings means that you can make a copy of material for broadcast purposes. So, like a radio station, it might make a copy of all these different songs from various albums onto a new medium and use that for broadcast purposes. That's perfectly fine. Again, but they can only keep it up to a certain length of time. I think it's like 6 months. Then you've got things like the distance education study, which was really, it was worded this way into the DMCA because the you know, Congress wanted to explore ways to promote distance education to give people more opportunities for educational purposes. So that was just really kind of put in there to say, let's put a placeholder here and really think about what this means. So it doesn't directly affect the DMCA in this case, but later legislation definitely does. The nonprofit libraries we've already kind of talked about. Webcasting was interesting because this ended up setting up certain rules that Internet radio stations have to follow that terrestrial radio stations don't necessarily have to follow. And this has caused a lot of concern among both parties.
Sure, yeah. And this is why Pandora, for example, works the way that it does. If you've ever used Pandora, you know that it will never play a specific song that you tell it to play right off the bat.
Right.
It has to take a sample of similar songs and play them in a random order. It
right.
also cannot play a certain song more often than, you know,
a certain amount of time. Yeah, there's usually, like, the rules are kind of weird. Like, there's one that says you cannot have the same songs from the same album play in like a 3 hour period.
Sure.
Or you can only do a certain number. Like it's really,
and it's
really
also,
specific, weird rules.
Yeah. And it's why you can't skip too many songs at once because
right.
it might, mess with the algorithm and force something to be randomly played sooner than it
right,
otherwise
right.
would have been.
Yeah. And then also there's even things about like if you have a looping program that's broadcast on the internet, it has to be at least 3 hours long. Like you can't have a 1 hour, like let's say you made a playlist and it's about a 1 hour long playlist. You could not have that being looped on the internet because it's not long enough to meet these requirements.
Wow. Yeah.
Also, of course, if you were playing anything that was under copyright, you would have to pay whatever the appropriate licensing fees were in order to have that. And that's also an issue, but we won't, you know, that's almost its own podcast really to cover all of those issues. The motion picture section has to do with residual payments that go out whenever a motion picture or movie, as some of us are, or film even, if we want to go old school.
Super fancy.
But, you know, there are residual payments that go out to the people who worked on a film whenever it's being broadcast or played or whatever. And so that's what that part of the Title IV had to do with it. Now we get to Title V, which is my favorite of all the titles because it is the one that makes my brain explode. So I am going to tell you what Title V covers, and I promise this is not a joke. Now keep in mind, this is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Yes.
So the DMCA Title V says, the Vessel Hull Design Protection Act creates a new form of protection for the design of vessel hulls. And you might say, wait a minute, are you talking about, and yes I am,
boats.
Talking about boats, people. So it creates a new system for protecting original designs of certain useful articles that make the article attractive or distinctive in appearance. That means it's specifically about the aesthetic design of a boat hull. It is limited to the hulls of vessels no longer than 200 feet. In the DMCA. It's not digital. It's a design. This could apply to something that's written on paper. There's nothing digital about this. It has nothing to do with the rest of the act. It is just about boats. Now, you know what makes me think? It makes me think that some old senator out there, and apologies to you, old senator, if you're the one who said this, but
clearly these boats are for surfing the interweb.
See, now what I think is there was an old senator out there who was saying, protecting against piracy, something. Piracy, huh? All right, piracy. Well, let's protect the boats. And also probably said that the internet is a series of tubes. Oh, it drives me crazy. This, by the way, if you are not from the United States, hey, this is how our law works.
Yay!
We have laws where occasionally you're reading through the law and something completely not connected to the rest of the law gets thrown in there. For reasons that are probably best not explored, because it will just make you despair over the state of affairs in the legal system in the United States.
Well, you know, they really wanted to pass it through. This was a big popular thing that was going on, and they figured, you know, those kids with their internet surfboards and their piracy are never going to notice.
Oh, it's just
so
it's,
let's just. I mean, if, let's if just do it now.
When I read it, I thought, this has got to be a joke.
I thought,
there's no other humor in this very long document that I'm reading. Why would this be the only thing? I don't get it. It's so ridiculous. Okay, well, and anyway, there are a lot of parts about the DMCA that make my brain angry and want me to go Hulk smash. But this is probably the capper on it, both figuratively and literally, since it is the last of the five titles. So that's the DMCA, folks. That's the those are the amendments to the existing law that all are there to try and protect copyright owners from having their works stolen willy and or nilly across the interwebs. It's been under fire many, many times for several of the passages within the DMCA. There have been lots of court cases that have challenged various parts of the DMCA with varying degrees of success. And, of course, there have been other proposed forms of law that kind of tie back into the DMCA. And some people say, well, why is this law being proposed? We already have the DMCA in effect in the United States, so therefore we should not pursue even more. Like, why are you painting over this fence that is already painted?
Painted extremely thoroughly.
Right, yeah. This is no...
Somehow into the air in the borders above the fence.
It's no Tom Sawyer job here, folks. This is a very well painted... We're bringing it back to Mark Twain.
We are.
Very literary podcast today. So, it's kind of interesting. It's also kind of infuriating. I do understand the perspective of copyright holders and wanting to protect their property. I don't necessarily agree with how it's come about, but I totally agree with the desire to do so.
Some measures clearly had to be made to prevent things like our buddies Napster from...
Yeah. And again, like my argument is still that if you make something that's easy for people to buy, and if you have guaranteed the quality of that product, then people will tend to buy it.
Yeah.
If you can't do that or won't do that, then people are more willing to try and find, you know, underhanded means of getting access to that content. And I mean, if you make it attractive enough, if it's priced fairly, and if it's, again, the quality is guaranteed, then a lot of people are going to say, well, I would rather buy it than run the risk of downloading a some sort of virus to my computer from a torrent site, because I have no real way of knowing if what I think I'm downloading is actually what I'm downloading.
Yeah. Even if legal penalties cannot deter you.
Yeah. Sometimes hackers can.
Hackers can.
Yep. Well, I guess that wraps up this discussion. I'm going to go and dip my head in a bucket of water to cool down. Guys, if you have suggestions for upcoming episodes of Tech Stuff, I highly recommend you get in touch with us. Our email address is techstuff@discovery.com. Or you can drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW. And Lauren and I will talk to you again, assuming we're not blocked by copyright, really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.